Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, a single cow diagnosed with mad cow disease in Washington state. Will it be the only one? And is the government doing enough to protect our food supply?
Certainly, we test only a tiny fraction of injured, diseased animals.
Also, the latest on the orange terror alert and the vulnerability of cargo planes. And wait till you hear a computer software program that sings like the human voice. We'll have food for thought for those who love and hate the kitchen from Alton Brown of the Food Network and the journalistic coup of the year, maybe of all time. We'll talk to the reporter who interviewed and has now written the first authorized biography of Santa Claus. These stories and more coming up here and now. This news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. military says three U.S. soldiers were killed in a roadside bombing near the central Iraqi city of Samarra. A suicide car bomber struck a government building in northern Iraq. From Baghdad, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Briefing reporters, Deputy Commander of Operations Mark Kimmett said that two U.S. soldiers were killed immediately and a third died later of injuries. The troops were traveling around 9 a.m. local time near the city of Samarra, north of Baghdad. An improvised explosive device of the sort favored by anti-U.S. insurgents struck their convoy. The bombing came just hours after U.S. aircraft and artillery pounded suspected guerrilla hideouts south of Baghdad in the most serious barrage the city has seen in months. A spokesman for the 1st Armored Division said Operation Iron Grip was aimed at insurgents who were expected to step up attacks during the holiday period. In the northern city of Erbil, a suicide car bomb blew up the entrance of the Interior Ministry headquarters, killing at least one civilian. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Baghdad.
Meanwhile, authorities are still searching for Izzat Ibrahim al-Douri. He was one of Saddam Hussein's top aides. He's now one of the most wanted individuals by the U.S. military because he's suspected of planning insurgent attacks against U.S.-led troops. A large number of Americans say they plan on taking holiday trips this year, despite the heightened security alert. AAA says nearly 60 million people will be traveling, most by car, but 8 million will fly. Chicago Public Radio's Lisa Labas reports.
Whether flying or driving, AAA says holiday travelers can count on seeing more police and military patrols after the terror alert level was raised to orange. On roads, police are dealing with terrorism concerns and the usual holiday efforts to get people to drive sober and buckle up. In Illinois, police are staffing more than 100 roadside checkpoints through the beginning of January. Airport screeners are working overtime. The Transportation Security Administration says airports have increased car inspections, parking restrictions, and bomb-sniffing dog patrols. Air travelers should arrive 2 hours before departure. AAA has some advice for all travelers. Have photo ID ready and keep luggage well organized to avoid unnecessary rummaging at security checkpoints. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labas in Chicago.
A British space probe is on track to land on Mars tomorrow. The Beagle 2 is scheduled to arrive on Mars's surface. The main probe, the Mars Express, will continue to orbit and relay pictures from Beagle 2 back to Earth. They're searching for evidence of organic life as well as for water. The British probe is the latest of 34 missions to Mars since 1960. Two-thirds of them have failed, including a Japanese effort earlier this month. Wall Street will close early today. Currently, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 27 points at 10,314. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, fears over the report of a Washington state cow infected with mad cow disease has prompted several countries to ban U.S. beef imports. Japan, Malaysia, Australia, Taiwan, Brazil, Chile, Singapore, Thailand, and Hong Kong have all blocked imports. Russia has now issued a temporary ban, and Mexico has joined the group. The European Union already bans U.S. beef because of fears over growth hormones fed to U.S. cows. Canada says it's taking a wait-and-see approach. Mixed news on the economic front today. While the government said unemployment claims continue to inch down, other reports suggest growth may be less robust than expected. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The Labor Department said the number of new unemployment claims last week was 353,000. Economists typically say that such a number suggests some moderate job growth. On the other hand, the Commerce Department said that orders for durable goods declined unexpectedly in November, falling at their steepest rate in a year. The numbers indicate that the nation's manufacturing sector may not be recovering as fast as economists had thought. There was also an unexpected drop in the sales of new homes. It was the third month in a row that sales have been down. This happened despite a drop in mortgage rates, which have fallen to levels not seen since July. The reports bolster the view that growth is moderating after its big third-quarter surge. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
The Baseball Players Association wants to know if baseball teams and free agents are colluding to slow down the gain in player salaries. The association says the salary average this year is a little less than $2,400,000, a record, but the Players Association says it's still a slowdown. This is NPR News.
The NPR Shop offers compilations of music featured on NPR programming, including the new I Heard It on NPR box set at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's here and now. Seven countries so far say they're banning American beef following the discovery of a single American cow infected with mad cow disease. There is concern that this cow is not the only one. Federal officials say they don't know yet where the cow was born. Now, that matters because the disease infects animals through contaminated feed, raising the question, did other cows eat the same contaminated food? New York Times reporter Eric Lischblau joins us to discuss the situation. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, start by telling us, just to remind us, what is mad cow disease and how's it spread?
Well, it's a disease that is spread through the nerve tissue of cows and is a debilitating disease that, if spread to humans, is almost always fatal. It obviously ravaged Europe in the late 80s and early 90s, and there's the fear, and at this point I don't think it's much more than a fear, that with the first case in the U.S., it could have similar repercussions here.
Now, Eric, the government says the meat supply is safe, but is it? Critics say every cow with unusual symptoms, meaning cows that are showing signs that they might have mad cow disease, they become weak, they start to fall down. Every cow with those symptoms is not necessarily tested.
Well, what the agriculture officials say happened in this case is that the cow in question was what they call a down cow, meaning that it was non-ambulatory. And for that reason, the parts of the cow which they say are able to spread the disease, namely the nerve tissue, the brain, that area, were not processed. And so any of the meat that was processed was skeletal bone cuts. And the science, according to the agriculture department, has shown that that is, in their view, not capable of spreading the disease. That's their reassurance that people should not be alarmed at this stage.
Yeah, but there's that larger picture, isn't there? Scientists conducted tests on about 20,000 cattle in fiscal year 2003 in the United States. But that's out of how many cattle in the U.S.? Is there sufficient testing?
Certainly there are some people who think there's not sufficient testing. In fact, there was a lawsuit that ironically was just revived about a week ago in New York in the Second Circuit from a group of animal rights activists who say that basically by even allowing the processing of downed animals, we are endangering the public. And their view is that that practice is in itself dangerous. And the 20,000 that you mentioned is out of about 600,000 downed animals each year. So certainly we test only a tiny fraction of injured, diseased animals.
Economically, of course, the potential for catastrophe for the U.S. beef industry is enormous. We're still not importing Canadian beef after a single cow in Canada came down with the disease this year. Has the British beef industry ever recovered?
Not really. I mean, certainly what they suffered in the late 80s and early 90s, they're still living with today. And I think countries around the world, especially Japan, are ultra-sensitive to the possibility of importing infected beef. You know, I think the main mission now for the United States is to calm the jittery nerves out there. I think they have both an economic crisis they're looking at and a public health crisis, probably in that order.
Eric, do you have any sense of the numbers? How much could be lost to the cattle industry, the beef industry? In the United States?
Certainly there's billions at stake. I mean, Japan is the biggest importer of U.S. beef, and Japan was the quickest to act in this case. So the risk to beef manufacturers and exporters in the U.S. is enormous.
And Eric, I suppose we could ask, what about the larger economy that surrounds beef, restaurants and so on and so on?
Right. I mean, certainly there's already been, just since last night, a ripple effect in terms of stock prices for fast food companies, for McDonald's, Walmart. They are already putting out statements saying that they don't think their beef is affected. But, you know, certainly there's a trickle effect that could impact everyone.
Eric, you know, as somebody who covers Washington, how successfully do you think the bureaucracy, if you will, can calm nerves when a disease is as elusive to find as this is, as mysterious in a way, it's just kind of popped up? I mean, Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman says she will eat beef for this Christmas, but isn't there the potential for people to just say, you know, I'm just not going to take a chance?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely that chance. There's a protocol that the agriculture developed, I think it was about 12 or 13 years ago, to deal with this very situation. So certainly they're aware that there's a need to respond aggressively and quickly. That's why they got the Secretary of Agriculture out there before the cameras so quickly last night. I think some people will say that their response was, even given all that, was fairly limited. I mean, the only immediate step they took was to quarantine the farm that the animal came from. Other steps, such as the possibility of a voluntary recall, slaughter of other animals who may have come into contact, those are several steps away, and some people say it might not have been enough quickly enough.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lichtblau is a reporter for The New York Times. Well, commentator Alice Furlow found an old cassette tape recently of a BBC radio broadcast. It's an Advent address by Prince Philip of England in which he talks about human stewardship of the earth and the environment. Alice sent us the tape along with her observations.
If people with knowledge and in positions of influence, power, or...
I was in my kitchen in Paris when I heard on our tiny scratchy radio on the refrigerator that Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, was about to preach the Advent sermon at Windsor. So I quickly set up a microphone and recorded it as best I could. I've heard that the prince is an awful crosspatch, but he is a convinced Christian and a passionate environmentalist. He begins by reminding Christians of their belief that God created this planet, and in this creation there's the interrelationship of the natural systems and the dependence on each other of all living species, including our own. He then says,
what believers in all religions ought to know, and what we seem to have forgotten, is that God has put limits to the endurance of all natural systems. And the evidence is mounting that the human species is stretching those limits to the point of breakdown.
The prince then gives a rather grim warning to heads of state.
If people with knowledge and in positions of influence, power, or authority are not very careful, their decisions could achieve the ultimate idiocy by starting a process of decline that could condemn our own species itself to extinction.
One of those people with power and authority now, of course, is President Bush. And I keep wondering how warmly he was welcomed by that old crosspatch, Prince Philip, when Bush was a guest at Buckingham Palace last month. The prince can't approve of the damage Mr. Bush and his colleagues are doing to America's wild places and wild animals. But I doubt if Prince Philip has ever seen a California sea otter, my favorite threatened species of marine animal. For 3 years, I lived in a cabin on the coast in Big Sur, California, looking down at these fur creatures lying on their beds of kelp, cracking open abalone shells. A mysterious disease is reducing their numbers drastically these days. Yet, the Bush administration planned to lift a moratorium on oil drilling in a major expanse of the otter's habitat, along the coast from San Luis Obispo County to Santa Barbara County. At present, I hear, but it's only a rumor, that Governor Schwarzenegger is going to uphold the moratorium. So no drilling for the moment. I'll think of those otters when I play my old cassette of Prince Philip's sermon on Christmas morning. He ends it on a faint note of hope.
Christians need to use the annual celebration of the birth of our Lord as an inspiration to become better and more considerate guardians of his creation, so that its beauties and wonders, whether they are practically useful to us or not, can continue to praise him and give him the pleasure and satisfaction that he felt at the end of the fifth day when he saw all that he had made, and it was very good.
Prince Philip of England in a sermon at Windsor Castle in the mid-1980s, brought to us by commentator Alice Furlow. More information is emerging about the orange terror alert the country's under this holiday week. Officials now say many safety concerns center around cargo planes possibly being used as passenger aircraft were on 9/11. Joining us from Washington to talk about the state of air freight security is Rafi Ron, president of New Age Security Systems. Rafi, welcome.
Thank you.
Rafi, progress has been made, it seems, on commercial aircraft security since 9/11. What about air cargo?
Well, I think that by now we all understand that on 9/11, since the aircraft was the goal of the terrorists, passengers did not play a role as targets. And therefore, when you want to take over an aircraft and use it against a ground target, a cargo airplane could serve you just as well, and in many cases maybe even better than a passenger aircraft, because by now, most passengers are aware of the risk of being hijacked and will not sit back and just wait for the tragedy to take place.
Yeah, and Rafi, have aircraft that carry cargo had, for example, cockpit doors reinforced like commercial aircraft?
Well, most of them don't. That is part of the problem. Cargo-designated aircraft are not under the same level of protection that we get for passenger aircraft.
But just
and
as lethal.
That is where the risk is.
Yeah, just as lethal as a plane with a lot of people in it, obviously.
Exactly. Actually, there are many of these cargo aircrafts are wide-bodied aircraft, or in other terms, the big, heavy 747s. They travel to long distances. They carry a lot of fuel. And at the same time, they are not enjoying the same level of protection, both in terms of protecting the cockpit or any other type of protection. More than that, I would say that we could have felt a little bit more comfortable if we had known that airport ground security is already exercised at a reasonable level. But I'm afraid that when we look at what has been achieved during the last couple of years, we see that almost all of it was invested and achieved in the area of passenger screening process. While issues like perimeter security and access control did not receive the same level of attention and investment.
And what about air cargo? How well screened is that?
Yeah, well, that's a part of the issue because the air cargo itself is not being screened.
Only 10% of U.S. air cargo is screened, I understand.
Well, that is true, but you must understand that, again, we're talking about mostly about those small pieces that would go into passenger aircrafts rather than the cargo-designated aircraft. And we have seen about 4 months ago there was an embarrassing incident where a person shipped himself in a crate, I think that
he was just a kid. He wasn't a particularly sophisticated
exactly
stowaway.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that this is a very good example as to a part of the risk that we should be concerned about, because people can ship themselves in boxes and can gain access to cargo aircrafts by doing that. And also, when I mentioned perimeter security, it also refers to the accessibility of cargo aircrafts when they are on the ground. And therefore, this is a subject that we must look at quickly and deal with that threat, because the threat is real.
Not pleasant stuff to talk about, Rafi, this holiday week, but it's there. Rafi Ran is president of New Age Security Systems and the former security director for the Israeli Airport Authority. Rafi, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Tonight really is the night. He's on his way. And I think you know who he is. Santa Claus. Who's, of course, one of the kindest men who ever lived, and internationally famous. But he's also a bit of a man of mystery. Who is Santa Claus, really? Once you get beyond his taste in clothes, and we might note his slight weight problem, what do we really know about this kind and magical man? There are lots of rumors and legends out there, of course, but now we're going to have a chance to cut through a lot of that with my next guest. And that's because he's not only actually met Santa, he's now helped write Santa's own, never fully told before, true life story. The book is called The Autobiography of Santa Claus, as told to Jeff Gwynn, who now joins us from the studios of KUHF in Houston, Texas. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you. Well, Jeff, we're certainly sorry Santa himself can't join us, but he's a very busy man at the moment. But you've actually gotten to meet him and work with him on this book. How did that all come about?
Well, a few years ago, I wrote a story for my newspaper about the traditions of Christmas that we enjoy so much. But maybe we don't really know where they came from, how they started, everything from why December 25th to how did he get the name Santa Claus.
Yeah.
The story ran, and a few months later I was contacted by someone who said, we can tell you love the holiday, though you don't know as much about it as you pretend to, and he would like to talk to you. And after some traveling, there I was up at the North Pole talking to him, Santa.
It was kind of magical how you got up to the North Pole, huh?
Well, it was. There's some things that we can talk about and some we can't. But as Santa points out in the book, some things that he does are part illusion, which can be explained. But there's also magic involved, and magic can't be explained. It simply is.
Yeah. You know, Santa's lived a very long life, Jeff. Your book is about Santa's long, long life. His story starts in 280 A.D., and that's, you know, how long ago is that? That's nearly 2,000 years ago. Santa started out as a boy named Nicholas, right?
That's true. Now, anytime anyone says, oh, Santa's not real, it's all made up, that's simply not the case. Nicholas was born in 280 AD in a town called Patara in a country then known as Lycia, which is part of Turkey today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was orphaned early. He was raised by the priests of the early Christian church, and he went on to become first a priest and then a bishop in the church himself. That's why he wears red and white to this day. Mm. Bishops in those times often wore red robes with white trim. So what we see when Santa's coming to our homes today is pretty much a variation on the same thing he was wearing all those centuries ago.
Now, he's had so many adventures, Santa Claus, over these nearly 2,000 years. We won't be able to get to every one, but tell us how Charlemagne, the great emperor from around the year 800, became involved with Santa.
Charlemagne said that he wanted his coronation to be held on Christmas Day. Now, we celebrate Christmas on December 25th because after the Romans adopted Christianity as their religion, they simply used the same day, December 25th, they'd previously used to celebrate the birth of Mithras, a god they'd worshipped, to switch that over to the birth of Christ. That's why we use that date. Charlemagne felt that if his coronation were held that day, it would indicate he wanted a rule that would be generous, that would be kind, be all-encompassing to everyone. And it was natural, I think, that Nicholas, as he was best known then, would eventually meet with Charlemagne.
There are so many important historical figures who were involved with Santa: Attila the Hun, King Arthur of England, St. Francis of Assisi, and even Leonardo da Vinci, who had a very important impact on a very important aspect of what Santa does every Christmas, which is have reindeer pull him around the entire globe so he can leave toys for kids. Tell us about the connection to the great artist and genius and inventor, Leonardo da Vinci.
In the late 1400s, Leonardo da Vinci, who was an inventor besides being an artist, filled whole notebooks with designs of flying machines, great flying sleighs and other objects. And these, he felt, would work this way. If a wagon, if a sleigh, if something could be pulled fast enough and there were wings on the sleigh, air mass underneath the wings would lift the sleigh up and it could fly. And since Santa wants to be what children expect, he had to find a way to fly. Fortunately, Leonardo da Vinci was one of his helpers. And the sleigh described in this book is based on the design that Leonardo had made in his notebooks. So even the sleigh, even the flying reindeer, they have their historical precedent. But until Santa told me about it, I hadn't realized.
Yeah, behind every legend about Santa, there seems to be, having read his autobiography now, a true story, and it all kind of starts to make sense. Now, Jeff, what would you say to a little girl or boy who this Christmas might be having doubts about whether Santa really exists or not?
I would tell them what I've been telling children all along since I've been writing this book, that Nicholas was as real as you or me, that the things that they're celebrating are based on real people. It's real history. They're not taking part in some kind of myth building. They are extending real history. When they believe in Santa Claus, they're believing in generosity of spirit, and they're simply continuing the wonderful tradition that was started centuries and centuries ago by a little boy who was born in what is now Turkey.
Jeff, thank you so much, and a very Merry Christmas to you.
I'll tell Santa you send your best.
I sure do. Jeff Gwynn tells the life story of St. Nick in the new book, The Autobiography of Santa Claus.
They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is going to find if reindeer really knows how to fly.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll look at Iraq at the end of a turbulent year with someone who's just been there, and Afghanistan 2 years after the Taliban. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. We'll be right back.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Vocaloid, computers that sing like humans. Well, you be the judge.
Come on, yeah, yeah. Sing to me, baby.
Also, Food Channel host Alton Brown tells us why he learned to cook.
Usually if I asked a girl out to dinner, she'd say no, with usually an obnoxious laugh following. But I did find that if you offer to cook a girl dinner, she'd at least be intrigued enough to not say no immediately.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Bob C. with these news headlines. More U.S. soldiers have been killed in a roadside bombing in Iraq. Lourdes Navarro is in Baghdad.
The U.S. military says three U.S. soldiers have been killed after a roadside bomb exploded next to their convoy near the town of Samarra. Samarra has been the scene of a number of ambushes and battles pitting insurgents against the U.S. military. And a series of sweeps were launched there by U.S. troops over the weekend, targeting rebel forces.
10 countries have now blocked American imports of beef after a cow tested positive for mad cow disease in Washington state. Japan, the world's top importer of U.S. beef, has imposed an indefinite ban and plans to recall certain meat products already on the market. Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman says there's no need to fear eating beef.
We continue to believe that the risk to human health from this situation is extremely low and that people should continue to feel very confident in the safety of our meat supply.
South Korea halted customs inspections on American beef and suspended sales for meat already on supermarket shelves. Although Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi says he will give up his country's weapons of mass destruction, leaders in Egypt and Syria are refusing to follow his lead. Leaders of both countries say they want Israel to eliminate its suspected nuclear arsenal first. Gaddafi's call to disarm is believed aimed at Syria, which the U.S. claims has chemical weapons and sponsors terrorism. The continuing strife in the Middle East has cut the number of people who gather in Bethlehem's Manger Square for Christmas Eve festivities. Most visitors are staying away due to the past 3 years of fighting between Israelis and Palestinians. Hundreds of thousands of visitors used to throng Bethlehem streets. This year, the few tourists who were there complained about the police presence, the lack of religious feeling, and the state of Bethlehem itself, which has been hurt by the fighting. America's factories saw orders for big-ticket goods drop by 3.1% in November. That's the largest decline in more than a year, and it raises new questions about the manufacturing sector. The drop is reported by the Commerce Department in orders for durable goods, and it comes after a brisk 4% advance in October. The stock market is headed down over worries about mad cow disease. Not much time left for a rebound as Wall Street closes for the holiday in about a half an hour. Right now, the Dow is off 29 points at 10,312. The Nasdaq is down a point at 1974. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. From Maria Callas to Elvis to Britney, every voice is unique, right? Well, yes, but what if there were a way to recreate these voices with a computer to a degree that made it tough to tell the real singer from the virtual version?
Come on, yeah, yeah. Sing to me, baby. Yeah.
that singer you're hearing, nice voice, huh? Well, except it's a computer program named Leon. Joining us on the line from London to explain is Ed Stratton. He's managing director of Zero G Limited, which licenses the new software called the Vocaloid. Welcome, Ed.
Hello there.
Well, Ed, tell us, what is Vocaloid?
Essentially, what they've done is to break down the English singing voice into its lowest common denominator parts. So, for instance, the word sound is made up of the S at the beginning, then the ow, and then N and D. That's a series of phonemes, if you like. And in the English language, there are only so many of those that we use.
Uh-huh.
And then we get a professional singer to sing all of those, not just isolated, but in context of words. Although I have to say, what we ask the singer to sing is complete nonsense, but it does encompass all of these phonemes. And at the end of that, we then start editing that and processing every single one of these transitions. And there are about 2,500 of them in the English language. At the end of it all, we really do have the English singing voice under our complete control.
And can you take a recording of Maria Callas singing an aria and then somehow take the textures of her voice and feed it into the computer and then figure out a way to have Maria Callas singing, say, White Christmas, and it sounds like Maria Callas, even though she never sang it? Is that how it works?
Yes. I mean, theoretically, this process should allow that to happen. In actual fact, when you actually think what a person is doing when they're singing expressively and the things that we enjoy when we're listening to that person, we're listening to the tone of their voice, which obviously is unique to them, but we're also, very importantly, listening to a whole myriad of different little expression techniques they use. All these little expressive elements, the user of the software, of the Vocaloid software, has to put those in manually. So the user decides which notes he wants to have vibrato on, and you just kind of drag and drop the vibrato icon onto the notes.
Uh-huh.
And then you can move the vibrato around and make it as long as you want on each note. And by getting quite skilled at using these, which is a very fun process, you can eventually add a great deal of expressiveness. And I think if you know this person's voice really well, then you'd know how to make it sound like her. And as long as you don't do anything too complex, you can get away with it, and you can totally fool anybody you play this to. They never would guess that it's a machine.
What are applications for it then beyond just having the fun of, you know, having Bob Dylan sing a nursery rhyme or something?
From the professional musician's point of view, the number one application is backing vocals. Lead vocals are harder work, but depending, again, what you're doing, you could find that Vocaloid is all you need.
Ed Stratton is managing director of Zero G. He joined us on the line from London. Thanks a lot, Ed.
Okay.
Well, now joining us with a real live musician's perspective on the software is Steve Steiner. Steve's with the Boston Lyric Opera and has, among other things in his career, trained singers. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Before we get to the music and listen to some of it, is there any buzz about this software in the singing world yet?
Actually, there isn't. Just when you folks had contacted me, that was the first. I think I had maybe read something in some kind of newspaper or something sort of along the way.
Well, let's listen to one of the demos. This is the Lola software singing Ave Maria. Steve Steiner, your reaction?
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Fooled if I hadn't told you beforehand that that was computer singing?
I don't think I would have been fooled. I don't think too many people would be.
What kind of an advance does it seem to be, though, over the sort of thing we've heard computer-generated voices do before, like when you call and you get those people giving you the weather report or somebody telling you what a phone number is and so on?
To me, that's a little bit abrupt as you listen to that. The change from vowel to consonant is a bit abrupt.
It's being pitched, so to speak, as immediately applicable, perhaps, as we heard, as backup singers. Do you think that even that is a bit ambitious or not?
I think it's possible. I think it's still a bit limited, and I don't see it yet being that wonderful a replacement for the human voice. I mean, people still want to hear, you know, hear the vowels, and it's all very calculated and changing. But I think what makes live singing so great is that the changes aren't so perfect, and that it is still kind of have that human edge to it, so to speak.
Let's hear a little more of Lola, this time doing Johann Sebastian Bach. You'd know if this were presented to you, if somebody put this on at a little gathering during dinner, you'd say, "What's that?" But
exactly.
you wouldn't think it was a human being.
So that's kind of cool, you know.
Yeah, right. So, as one of the maestros of Boston's Lyric Opera, do you think singers need to be watching their backs just yet?
Not yet. Although I can see, you know, because there are opera companies that even one or two in particular that are using synthesized orchestra. So there is a need, and there are not necessarily a need, but there's a desire on the part of some companies to cut corners financially. Are there great artistic benefits for that financial savings? No. I mean, I think you are definitely taking the next rung down in terms of artistic.
Yeah, I mean, there's the heart and the genius of an artist that can never be replaced by a machine.
Exactly. And that is, as I mentioned before, it's because it can easily be imperfect. It can easily derail. You know, you can fall off the tightrope, you know, and that's where the discipline of art and, you know, that's what makes it so exciting.
Steve Steiner of the Boston Lyric Opera joined us in the studio to talk about Vocaloid. Steve, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you.
Still to come, if you like to eat but can't imagine cooking, Food Channel host Alton Brown may help you to see the kitchen with fresh eyes. You're listening to Here and Now. Lenny Bruce is dead, but his ghost lives on and on. Thus spoke Bob Dylan in the song Lenny Bruce. And now New York Governor George Pataki has posthumously pardoned the controversial comedian for a 1964 obscenity conviction after an appeal by Lenny Bruce's daughter and also by many famous comedians. Here's Lenny Bruce.
There's semantics. There are words that offend me. Let's see, Governor Farbus, segregation offend me. Nighttime television offends me. Some nighttime television.
Well, joining me on the line is journalist Nat Hentoff of The Village Voice. And, Nat, you knew Lenny Bruce. You saw him perform. You took part in his trial. What's your reaction to yesterday's pardon?
Well, first of all, I'm pleased that Pataki did it. But what I'm even more pleased that there has been so much attention to this pardon. And it couldn't come at a better time. You know, I don't want to put words in the mouth of somebody who's no longer here. But Pataki's point that this pardon serves as a reminder of the precious freedoms we are fighting to preserve. Well, among them is, of course, the First Amendment, which Lenny was totally immersed in that subject in self-defense, but also because he was a true believer. And I'm glad you started with Bob Dylan, because Dylan had the best one-line summary of what has happened now and what happened to Lenny then. Lenny Bruce is dead, but he didn't commit any crime. He just had the insight to rip off the lid before it's time.
Nat Hentoff, just to finish and briefly, you knew the guy. Can you paint us a quick portrait of the guy you knew?
Lenny was a man of great passion. particularly about freedom of speech. But he also was an enormously skilled performer. He grew up working strip clubs on the West Coast when he started with jazz musicians, and they taught him, as it were, timing. And I hope this gets people of a certain age who weren't around when Lenny was around to go back and hear this man who has liberated Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, and a whole bunch of people now who are enjoying, as we are enjoying them, their First Amendment rights.
Writer and critic Nat Hentoff. Thanks so much, Nat.
Okay, thank you.
We turn now to comedian Jimmy Tingle. Jimmy, how important is Lenny Bruce to your generation of comedians?
First of all, he's a name we definitely revere, the comics of our generation. Anybody who ever gets on stage and tries to say something and be funny and also say something at the same time with content, I think has been influenced by Lenny Bruce. Most of my generation has, anyway. You know, he gets a reputation as being a dirty comic. He was making points. He was making social and political points with his humor. He was talking about things like segregation. He was talking about things about, like, war. One of the things he got in trouble for in New York City was he took a trip through East Harlem, I guess, and saw all this squalor and then, you know, this fictitious strip, and then went to the bishop and said, listen, you with just your ring, you could help these people out of poverty.
Yeah, $10,000 ring joke.
Yeah, right. And I guess what that did is, you know, that upset the church at the time, and they helped influence the pressure that came upon him. The ultimate irony, I think, is 40 years later, Lenny Bruce is being pardoned and the church is on trial.
Jimmy, that may be the last word. Comedian Jimmy Tingle, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Comedian Jimmy Tingle. For more information on upcoming performances by Jimmy, check out our website at here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Lenny, my name is Sergeant Bumba. You know the word you said? I said a lot of words that time. Well, that word. Oh, yeah. Well, Lenny, that's against the law. I'm going to take you down. Okay, that's cool. It's against the law to say it and to do it. Well, I didn't do it, man. I know, but...
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Few places on Earth both intimidate and simultaneously kind of bore some of us more than the kitchen. Sorry, it's true. But then the other day, I saw a half-hour television program on the kitchen and on food. In fact, it happened to be about beets.
Hi, I'm Alton Brown, and today on Good Eats, we're cooking beets. Look, I know beets can be a little bit scary, okay? Especially if you were raised on canned ones the way I was. But trust me.
Beets, one of the few vegetables I really dislike the taste of, especially since my Irish grandmother used to push them on me all the time when I was a kid, which is another story entirely, of course. But my point is, this show on cooking beets, I really liked. I can't quite say just yet that if I had a beet in front of me, I'd eat the whole thing. But I certainly watched the whole thing, and it made me want to watch more and learn more about cooking. Good Eats is on the Food Channel, and host Alton Brown joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Alton, welcome to you.
Hi. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty good.
Besides a little more receptive to beets.
A little bit more receptive to beets and cooking and the kitchen in general since watching a bit of Good Eats. Alton, you know, you really did make it interesting. How did you get started? Have you always been fascinated with food yourself?
I got serious about cooking when I was in college because I couldn't get dates. and I found that usually if I asked a girl out to dinner, she'd say no with usually an obnoxious laugh following. But I did find that if you offered to cook a girl dinner, she'd at least be intrigued enough to not say no immediately. So that kind of got me into cooking.
So you came at it with kind of a whimsical purpose, which kind of seems to translate.
No, not whimsical. Very direct very, purpose.
I was
trying to get action.
Actually, there was a desperation factor there.
It was extraordinarily desperate. And sad in so many ways.
Well, maybe that explains those romantic interludes in the beach show. You kept cutting away to a couple speaking Spanish by a window. It didn't seem to have a lot to do with the show. Kind of nutty and wonderful.
We were trying to play on the fact that people were changing the channel, see? You know, like one time they would change the channel and be a used car ad, and I'd pop into that. Another time was a Godzilla movie, only I would take the hat off and I would be, you know, inside the Godzilla suit. And the whole thing was is that people were trying to get away from the beats, and I wouldn't let them. Look, you got me feeling like Sam I Am here, okay? Just give Beats a chance, would you? I won't make you eat them in a box or with a fox. I won't make you eat any borscht or any dyed eggs or anything. Just nice, straightforward, good eats. Now, come on, let's go back to my channel, okay?
How did you come up with the format? As you say, the show starts out with you in a gorilla suit, was it, or a Godzilla suit?
Godzilla.
Raging,
you need to work on your
raging around the
there.
Set. This every, is not ju- this is not Julia Child, Alden.
Well, Julia Child meets Monty Python and drinks a bottle of tequila. Every episode of Good Eats is completely different. That's actually the only thing that kind of ties them all together, except that I'm in them. But it all came out of the fact that I used to direct television commercials.
Oh.
That was my trade, and I cooked as a hobby. And I would watch food shows to try to actually learn how to cook. But when I watched food shows, by and large, and this was back in the 80s, I didn't learn anything. You know, I would get – it would a half hour of boring television would go by and okay, I had a few recipes and that was about it. And so I guess in the early 90s I started thinking, you know, somebody ought to make a food show for my generation, a generation that was raised on MTV and Saturday Night Live, a show that would entertain as much as it would educate. And enough time went by and I actually got married, hooked another girl with food, but she stayed. And she was my producer and she said, well, you know, why don't you do it? Why don't you make the show? And I said, okay, I will. And she said, well, guess not. What? Nobody's going to let you because you don't know enough. And so we both quit our jobs and I went to culinary school, worked in the restaurant industry. And then finally one day she said, you know, it's not that I really mind living on $20,000 a year, but I think it's about time you start writing those TV shows.
One of the nice things about the show is besides the nuttiness and, you know, it's also, you know, it's a food show.
Nuttiness,
show.
That's a pun. That's funny because we just finished a nut show.
So. Did you? One of the nice things about it is that you also, I wouldn't say you get serious, but you actually have a food anthropologist. Throughout, you'll spice it up, so to speak. We can get really carried away with these food analogies. With little facts from history about beets or nuts or whatever you're talking about, why'd you put that in?
For one thing, people love trivia. People just enjoy knowing things. But it puts things in perspective. You know, I think that we take so much for granted today food-wise because we live in a culture that has access to more edibles than any culture ever on the planet of the Earth. And it's real easy to just, you know, toss them aside as insignificant items, be it a beet or a beef roast.
Alden, for a food novice, somebody who's very new to the kitchen, where do you start? I mean, it's so overwhelming in a way for someone who doesn't know much about cooking. What would you recommend to somebody who kind of really wants to learn how to cook a bit but doesn't even begin to know where to begin?
You've got to have some guides. I mean, for instance, you know, getting a couple of decent cookbooks, asking if you're a young person or, you know, your parents are still around, ask for some of the recipes you grew up on that can help you get started. And then you've got to stock up on equipment. You've got to stock your kitchen with the right gear to get you going. And I think that actually frightens more people than anything else because we tend to inherit bad tools and then keep them around and say, well, we don't like cooking. You know, most of the people that I ask about that when they say, well, I don't like cooking, say, well, you know, show me your pots and pans, show me your knives. And you look at them and it's like, well, okay, cavemen in certain regions had better things than this. So unfortunately in our culture today, it's really hard to tell the good tools from the bad tools from a packaging standpoint. And then we usually buy things in retail operations where quite frankly, the people that work there may know even less about what they're selling than the people doing the buying.
What would you say to someone who is a very experienced cook is the most important lesson you may have for them that they may not already know?
I would say that learning to use your brain and not just executing steps, but actually
not just following a recipe.
Following a recipe is one thing, but sitting down and really understanding a recipe is another. One of the practices that I have whenever I come across a new recipe that I think I want to try out is I sit down at the kitchen table with the recipe and a pad and kind of rewrite it. Because that's just how I absorb things better, and kind of reorder it and look at what it really is, figure out what's really going on. Too many people just blaze into recipes. They just dive in and they start cooking and they get halfway through and realize they've made mistakes and errors and they get bogged down in things. So I would say proper mental preparation is a pretty big deal.
Looking at one of your books, I noticed, too, that something as simple as heating, you say, is something very basic and important to cooking that a lot of cooks don't quite manage well.
Heat defines cooking, not flavors, not ingredients, not fancy sauces, heat. And if you don't learn how to manage heat, you cannot cook. I guess that's kind of a good answer for your previous question about what's the one thing that they really ought to know and don't often think about is that heat is an ingredient. It is involved in every cooking journey. Of course, now I'm talking about things like, slicing sushi. Of course, that's not cooking. That's preparation. As is any other food that is served raw. So really making a friend of heat and learning how to use heat, understand heat, how it moves, what it does, how food reacts to it, that's about as basic as you can get.
Hmm. What is it that you love most about cooking?
This is probably going to sound kind of odd. Cooking made me smarter. I used to be marginally bright and not very bright. Didn't know much. Didn't understand much about the world and how things work in the world. But cooking is the switchboard of the sciences, okay? And it is a switchboard that combines or brings together anthropology, philosophy, history, chemistry, physics, biology, so many different aspects of what I like to think of as the human experience. They really all come together in food. And it was through trying to figure out food and cooking and understand what's going on in the kitchen that I got smarter. I can hold my own in conversations about chemistry now, which I certainly couldn't do in school. And so for me, it is the acquisition and interrelationship of knowledge. I love that. And for me, cooking is its own reward. Because the more you know about what's going on in the kitchen, the more fascinating it is just to watch those eggs scramble. And people sometimes ask me, don't you ever get tired of just scrambling eggs? I'm like, no, because when you start understanding what's going on in there, it's like, let me put it this way. My grandfather on my mom's side was an auto mechanic, and he loved nothing more than taking like long rides in the countryside. And I remember once being when I was a kid, I asked him, don't you ever get tired of just riding around? And he said, no. And I said, why? And he pointed up to the engine. He said, because I know what's going on in there.
Yeah.
And that's what being in the kitchen is like for me. Once you start understanding what's going on in there, it is infinitely fascinating.
Alton Brown, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Food Channel host Alton Brown is the author of several books. The latest is Alton Brown's Gear for Your Kitchen. Here and Now is a production of WVUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and happy holidays. Join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join us next time for the news in these stories Here and Now. We'll look at Iraq at the end of a turbulent year with someone who's just been there, and Afghanistan 2 years after the ouster of the Taliban. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.